Hello, everyone, and welcome to another podcast interview here with Dan Bigham, who, well, his first appearance, I'm joking, obviously not, but great to have you here, Dan, and it's been a very eventful year last year, and we're going to talk plenty about that, and I'm even going to venture into some tech stuff as well. But yeah, 2022, how was it for you overall?
Yeah, firstly, thanks for having me back for the 50th time. Love a chat, love a podcast. 2022. I was actually thinking about this on the turbo yesterday, about how the hell you step up on what a year that was. Not that at the start of the year I was like, this is gonna be amazing, gonna do all this stuff. But then you look back and you're like, okay, got married, got a baby on the way, broke the hour record and won the world champs in team pursuit. I was like, that's pretty fucking cool. It was a good year. And I was like, I did not anticipate that. Did not plan to try and tick all those boxes, and it just kind of all came together and made a pretty epic year. I don't think I'm going to top.
So, well, we can't not mention the hour record, as you just said. You had the British hour record. The big goal was the world hour record. How was it leading up to that event? You were so close in Gretchen the year before, but what kind of changed to just get those last few meters or what?
Last few meters, the extra 800 that I found.
Yeah, that's less than a kilometer.
800, that's not eight. What's that, like 5% drag reduction, something like that? Big gains. 800 meters.
So how did you do it?
16 watts. A lot of different things, really. I'm trying to remember back to it because it's actually, when did I do it? August. Yeah, so it's been like 5 months now. And you kind of, everything amalgamates into one big memory and you kind of start to forget some of the details. But I think the improvements probably came, well, you can split it in down the middle of energy in, energy out. And I know I've always talked about that as a concept, but the energy outside's always been where my passion lies, my interests, the technology, the application of maths and physics and science to make you go faster for no more energy. And I pushed that and pushed that, and I definitely made improvements. We collectively made improvements within INEOS Grenadiers, BioRacer, Cask, obviously Pinarello, Princeton, all coming together on what was a pretty awesome project. Muckoff actually as well made some good improvements there. Let's not forget them. But I think that probably only attributed for around 50% of my improvements. Sorry, call that about 400 meters. So the other 400 meters would come basically from physiology, 8 watts improvement, which doesn't sound a huge amount, but trying to find 8 watts on what is literally your threshold is pretty hard work. And a lot of that really didn't come from like raising the ceiling, as it were. So trying to get fitter as an athlete. It was more about trying to achieve what I was capable of doing, but making the environment more conducive to less drag and performing in that environment. So having it warmer, having it more humid is good for air density reduction, which means more speed for a given amount of power, but it also significantly reduces your cooling capacity. So how much you can cool is a function of how much water is already in the air, the humidity, and how hot it is. So that comes down to basically doing a lot of training to adapt your body to sweat more and to physiologically deal with the heat, but then also the preparations beforehand to get your core temp as low as it possibly can before you start, which is a super interesting project. And I talked about it quite a bit because for me, the physiology side's always been a bit kind of boring and frustrating because it's just kind of this black box of you apply a stimulus of riding your bike and maybe you get faster or maybe you don't. Whereas the physiology side of the thermal dynamics was really quite tangible and quite objective. So we collectively with Green Tech, we built this really cool model where you can tie in all the variables. So like what's the solar load from the lighting? How big is your body mass? What is your gross efficiency? Otherwise, obviously the atmospherics and all these different inputs you can put in, and it's like, okay, you can, under all these conditions with your current physiology, et cetera, ride out this power. And then you try and tweak all of those. Can you lower your core temp a bit more? Can you raise the core temp that you can get to at the end and sustain it without exploding? Can you achieve the same kind of growth efficiency with changing the temperature, the humidity, et cetera? It was all, a fun way of playing with physiology. And I normally get excited about the energy outside thing, but the energy in bit got me. And I think that was a massive improvement, to be honest. I was putting out pretty much the same numbers, maybe a little bit better, but in yeah, much more extreme environment.
So is this something that, well, is it going to be, well, obviously the elephant in the room, Ghana, you were part of that record attempt as well. Was that something you applied to Ghana's preparation as well?
Yeah, the entire project within INEOS Grenadiers was pretty much treated as like a sort of big R&D research project. What can we learn and what can we apply? And not just for Filippo's hour. Obviously, that was like the end goal, like properly destroy the hour record. And I'm pretty confident you can say Filippo's done that. But also, all of that knowledge stays within the team. It's not a case of, oh, it only applies to an hour record. We're riding bikes, whether it's indoors or outdoors, your physiology is still the same. And it's getting hotter. And pretty much any cyclist out there has realized the last few years, especially in the Tour de France, it's getting warmer and warmer and warmer, and thermal physiology is becoming more and more critical to performance. So the more we can understand about the physiology and how we can implement different things to our benefit, then the better we're going to perform in those extreme environments. So it was a really interesting project, not just to learn things actually as well, but to gain traction within the wider team so that they understand the impact of, say, an ice slushy beforehand or other pre-cooling strategies or doing heat training and what that looks like, so that they all buy into the process and suddenly the entire team is thinking about it and is trying to move this entire thing forward, rather than a couple of people within performance support saying, hey guys, you need to have some ice slushies before you go out and race. So it was really powerful for that. And obviously, yeah, Filippo used it to good effect as well. He was in on that, and yeah, did quite a bit of heat training. His sweating capacity was, obviously he's a bigger guy than me, a little bit more than me. I think he lost 2.5 kilos, something like that. Or was it 2.5, maybe 2.8 kilos over an entire hour? So quite a bit of sweat loss. And obviously that evaporates and that's what cools you down.
But so do you think that this, you're going to basically follow, like, obviously we know that a time trial is more intensive, but do you think this would be something you would apply to a road stage, the mountains, etc., like you said, with the Tour de France?
Yeah, we're definitely starting to. Time trials tend to have more benefit because you tend to hit higher core temperatures in time trials. It's you can't cool yourself and maintain homeostasis. Basically, you will drift up and drift up until, yeah, you start to negate that through putting out less power. So there was a really interesting study in was Qatar Worlds 2016, if I remember correctly. There was an interesting study there where they got a lot of the riders doing time trial and road race to ingest a core temp pill so they could log all the data, and all the highest core temp values were experienced in the time trial, not in the road race. So even though the road race is whatever it was, 5, 6, 7 hours out in the baking sun, their core temp is a lot lower because they're not putting out as much power. So they're not having to dissipate as much heat. Whereas in the time trial, when you're riding at say 400 watts, if your efficiency is 20%, then you've got another 1600 watts of energy to get rid of, or 1600 watts of power, sorry, to get rid of. Whereas in a road race, if you're only riding at 200, 250, it's it's a significant amount less that you're trying to dissipate, and you can manage it a whole lot better. You can't go and get ice slushies and drinks and things in a time trial, at least not very easily. Whereas in a road race, you can be strategic about how you get them and where you get them. So it's definitely got a bigger impact in time trials, but it still drastically impacts in road race performance as well.
Yeah, I was thinking that we're going to talk about the front end aerodynamics and we're going down a whole other route. But going back to the hour record, going back to the hour record, how was it for you? Kind of, because it's been a project for you, doing well at the hour record, and then here you are, you have the world hour record. How was that? Was it just relief, or was it just?
I'd say it was a whole lot of enjoyment. I definitely was like stressed and nervous. I think anybody, that would be normal before attempting the world hour record. But I'd kind of been through the motions. Obviously, I'd been really close with Joss when she'd gone and done it and seen how she dealt with it. And to be honest, I felt the same kind of pressure when I went for the British hour record, not quite the same, but I mean, you were there as well and you saw it firsthand. It's quite a ballsy thing to kind of put your hand up and go, yeah, I'm better than everybody. I'm going to show you. And on a specific day of your choosing with equipment of your entire choice, you go and show them. So you've got nowhere to hide. It's quite a scary thought. But back in June, just after the sub-7, sub-8 triathlon team time trial thing that we all did over in Germany, I went over to Switzerland and we did a full dry run. So dress rehearsal, going through literally everything, the same kind of warm-up, same kind of pacing strategy, trying to get everything as close as we can to what the actual event would be. And I broke Campenaerts' record in training by 127 meters, which was, okay, tight. That's by 127 meters is, well, not much, like 2 watts, just over. So real tight performance, but at the same time, really confidence inspiring to know you can go and do it. And that was on my old Argon before the improvements that we knew were bringing forward with the new Pinarello, the new Princeton disc wheels, etc. So I was quite confident going into it that it was wholly achievable as long as I executed, as long as I did what I knew I was capable of. So it was in my control, and therefore I needed to, yeah, execute and stick to the plan, stick to the pace and strategy throughout, and make sure that I just do all I can and not fall apart, keep your head together. And it kind of got to the, well, halfway, I had a bit of a wobble in my head. But then with about 10 or 15 minutes to go, kind of knew, yeah, this is doable. And it's more a case of, well, how much can you push it? And I was just riding on the absolute limit to the line. I couldn't get any more out, maybe a little bit in a few meters here or there with a better line. But on the whole, yeah, that was the best performance I put out. Maybe you could argue over 2 or 3 meters, but I don't think I had another 1.2 kilometers in me, that's for sure.
So you wouldn't do it again?
Never say never.
So now I'll do my best. We know how well of a tech expert you are, aerodynamics, now heat as well, but thermodynamics. But in terms of the bike, that for the Ghana record, this humpback whale inspired our record bike, what was kind of the new developments being brought back into it, or like brought into it?
Where did that come from? Funny enough, actually, myself and Filippo, we had the exact same bike. Not the actual one, but like all of it, I was on the same size. They were all printed, same features, just mine was hidden away and never really saw the light of day. So I was the first to ride that bike and test it and get some good data on it, which is pretty cool experience. Riding around on a basically a 3D printed bike. It's quite cool. The process itself began in, it was about March. It was a really tight timeline, to the point where at first we were thinking, okay, we're not going to get a bike done in the time frame from March to August. It's way too intensive. Anybody who designs bikes or even builds bikes knows that the timescales of getting tooling made or molds and tooling and all the ISO testing it's got to go through, plus the UCI approval, it's not feasible. So that kind of opened up the door of why don't we go down 3D printing rather than carbon composite, because it basically gave us about a 3 or 4 week window to design, develop and test the bike, which is no small amount of effort. And it was a combination of a whole lot of very intelligent people coming together. Obviously, Pinarello have their own R&D department. Within Ineos Grenadiers, we have a number of different engineers and aerodynamicists. So Luca Argiano, who's probably the smartest aerodynamicist nobody's really heard of in the sport. He is the brains behind so many things in cycling, and yet he hides in the shadows. And he's an incredibly good guy, and he led on a lot of the idea. And then also Dimitris Karsanis, who I'm sure people know from Metron, they printed the frame. He had a lot of ideas as well. And it was basically just meeting after meeting and design meetings and wind tunnel tests, CFD tests, and just doing all we can to fast track the process. So the humpback whale inspiration. So we were looking at a lot of different concepts. And the one thing that's really powerful with CFD is you can understand where your drag is coming from. Put simply, the vast majority of your drag on a frame, at least when it's very optimized, comes from seat post and seat tube. It's about 30-40% off the top of my head. So when you've got most of your drag coming from that area, that's typically for a reason. And when you look at it, you're getting a lot of separation, because what's happening is the seat post and seat tube are sitting between your legs. You're pedaling, and that means you've got a leg forward and a leg rearward, and that oscillates and alternates. So what happens with the airflow is it comes between your legs and then changes direction. So it's, I should say, your left leg is forward and your right leg is rearward. Onset flow would then turn behind the back of your left leg, which means the onset flow angle onto the seat post and seat tube is not straight ahead. It can be anything up to sort of 40, 45 degrees. Now, any normal airfoil would separate at that kind of angle. By separation, I mean, you induce a lot of drag off the airflow because the flow is no longer attached to it. So what you can do is you can do a lot of different things if you want. You can change the profile, you can make it really fat, rounded airfoil, or well, the route we went down was the tubercles. So the intention it was to basically control flow separation at high onset flow angles. That's what the original study was done on. And yeah, it works really well in that scenario. Hence why it's only on the seat tube and seat post and not everywhere, because your legs aren't between the fork or the down tube. The seat post sits right down the middle.
Do you think this is something we're going to see introduced on bikes going forward now?
Well, I hope it'll be on all the Pinarello bikes pretty soon. So I think it'll become more commonplace. It's not a silver bullet. You're not going to find 10, 20 watts there. It is a few watts, but that's what makes the difference. That's what we were chasing. We're already in a very optimized scenario. Probably as you get onto the road and things are a bit more variable. Depends on the scenario. You may find a little bit more, a little bit less. It's definitely an improvement. I expect you'll see a lot more of it out in the real world. I imagine people start to look into different profiles, how they work with different rider leg shapes, different cadences. You know, as you can start to optimize these things to the nth degree, but the big win was from the implementation of them as a shape. And then there's obviously a more optimization you could do around the shape of that and how that works with that frame, that rider, etc.
So I think you're probably the best person in the whole world to ask this. Our record is unified now. All the kind of different, what would you say, the different variants of the rule, courtesy of, Boardman, the Superman position bike as well, Graham O'Bree. But Ghana's beat it now.
Yep.
Do you think it's ever going to be even attempted or beat now, considering he kind of unified everything?
Absolutely. Probably in the next 2 or 3 years.
You think someone's going to beat it?
I think someone will attempt it. And I know of some people who can beat it as well. It's not impossible, that's the thing. Like, what he did was pretty epic. Obviously, he went a really long way in 1 hour. But Filippo is not superhuman. Like, what he can do is capable of others if they're willing to commit. But it's not just a case of you can ride at the same power. And let's say even on the road, you had the same CDA as Filippo. That's two components. But the hour is significantly more complex than that. Hence why me, an athlete who probably, well, I'm not really top 10 in the world TT. Maybe I'd scrape a top 10 on a really, really good day. But not many of the guys who are finishing top 10 at world time trial could beat me in the hour record. So that step difference comes from the application of science, the understanding of demands of that event and how you need to optimize around it. And there's so much that we did that I'm pretty sure other teams either wouldn't know about or wouldn't know where to start, because they don't have that history within track and the hour that Ineos has, or my background and my interest and my understanding of it either. And when you kind of apply that, we made a big leap forward in performance. I mean, from what I learned within the team, I found 800 meters, and we probably found Filippo at least that, maybe more. So I think people can do it, but they probably will be surprised at how hard it is as a challenge. But I don't think it's going to stand for decades, that's for sure. I think people will come along and they will beat it.
Do you think Ghana can beat it? Improve on
it? Oh yeah, definitely. It wasn't his best ride. I think he'd put his hands up and say that. I think we're quite confident from our analysis in the team. There's more there. It's a scary thought.
Do you think 60? I asked you this before, but do you think 60 kilometers in 1 hour is doable?
Been asked this a few times. It's not impossible.
I was the first one.
But it's so hard. So I would never say never. I'm not naive enough to claim there's some arbitrary limit, because 60 kilometers is just a made up number when it comes down to it. Why not 60.1 or whatever? It's the number's kind of a bit irrelevant. So I think it can be beaten. I don't think we'd see 60 for decades, but it's not impossible. But for Filippo to go from where he went, I mean, quick numbers off the top of my head, in the same conditions, is like another 70 watts, maybe even a bit more, probably even a bit more than that. So you're talking somebody who can do an hour at north of 500 watts at a very good CDA.
So what if you move it up a higher altitude?
It's more plausible at higher altitude. It's still not easy though when it comes down to it. It's you still got to ride up there. You still got to put out the altitude. Your savings still is significant, but you're not going to Filippo at altitude, even if you put the same power out. I don't think he'd beat it. I think he'd still have to up his power just slightly. This is off the top of my head. I haven't got a spreadsheet fired up at the moment, but I don't think the improvement to go to, say, even like a Cochabamba in Bolivia, which is 2,600, so even higher than Mexico, Aguascalientes, 2,600 from sea level, you maybe find 1,500 off the top of my head. So 58 and a bit. But that's still a good way from 60.
But yeah, Dan, moving on as well. Of course, you're not just well, we haven't even spoken about that. Well, partially. Ineos Grandes, performance engineer, our record hunter, but you're also now a world champion in the track with the Team Pursuit team. Where did that kind of come from? Obviously, you have an amazing background in team pursuiting, but yeah, you weren't on the GDV team last year.
It's a really good question. I think Joss felt the same because it came literally 6 days after our wedding, 7 days after, 6, 7 days after our wedding. So to kind of rewind the clock, back in March, was it March or was it April? No, it was March, the National Track Champs in Newport in the UK. They've been delayed actually because of COVID, I think. I think they were meant to be in January and they've been pushed back 6 weeks or 8 weeks, something like that, which is good because then I came to altitude, did a really good altitude block here in Andorra, and then went down because there was some terrible form in January. I got some good form by then. Rocked up and literally out of nowhere. And when I say out of nowhere, I mean, I didn't even think I was going to go that fast. Rode a 405.2, which knocked like 4 and a bit seconds off the national record. And I think put me third fastest rider in history at that time behind Garner and Ashton. So I was like, yeah, quite a scary performance. I was like, shit, where did that come from? Like, probably like dumbfounded myself a little bit, which is quite nice because I'd done so much prep and training around, yeah, TP, hour record stuff, obviously done the hour, but hadn't really like rolled it over into an IP and thought, what could I actually do in an IP or try to? So British hour record had been and gone in October 21, and then yeah, it'd been sort of 5, 6 months, and then I rocked up and did that, and I was like, gee, that's pretty cool. And yeah, GB obviously got a bit interested, and the plan was to trial me at the Nations Cup in Glasgow. So I went back to the UK just what, a week and a half before I managed to get COVID, literally tested positive the morning I was due to travel up to Glasgow. So that put paid to do the Nations Cup and push things back really into Commie Games, I think it would have been. So I did a couple of sessions on track with them in Derby, just when I was in the UK, just slot one in here or there. And then yeah, I went to Commie Games. Didn't do a great performance, to be honest, in TPIP. I really mistimed my altitude return to the point that I was, yeah, pretty, especially in the IP, I was horrific, really not good. Came good by the TT, obviously crashed out that, and then went into the hour record. So figured out altitude and timing, that's actually pretty important. And never really had ended up in that bad window before. But anyway, I'd done a good enough performance that GB were interested in putting me in for the World Champs for TP and IP. Had a really good block into that at altitude, came down from altitude, did a few training sessions at Derby, was going really well, had a wedding, got married, disappeared
At
the
our
following
wedding.
morning. Yeah. I was really good at it because we both had our record bells at the altar. So instead of like wedding bells, because it was in Joss's parents' garden, instead of wedding bells, they were ringing the our record bells. That was pretty cool. It was a really good wedding. Really good wedding. A really good day. Amazing day. So many good memories. I did enjoy it. People were like, you're not going to drink. I'm like, no, I'm here to have a good time. It's my wedding. I'm doing it once. I'm doing one again. I don't intend on. So yeah, that kind of maybe wouldn't have been ideal prep, but the wedding, we planned it like a year out, and I never ever thought I'd be going to the World Track Champs. So that was a bit of a curveball to fit in. But Ben Greenwood, the head coach of GB, sorry, the men's endurance coach at GB, was super supportive of the entire thing, appreciative that I had my own plans for the year and we've got to work around that, and I have a job and I live in another country. There's a lot of kind of barriers to me fitting in with the team, but he's been awesome for it. And yeah, so went to the world champs and kind of glued really well as a team. I already knew a lot of the guys. Obviously, I worked with Ethan Hayter through INEOS, and I've known him for many years, known Chazza. Actually, yeah, Chazza didn't come. Well, he's in the team, but he had COVID from a couple of weeks out and was feeling terrible, so he didn't end up joining us. Ethan Vernon was in what was Team KGF back in the day. So I've known Ethan for a good long while. And then Ollie Wood, who obviously I know of and have raced against him plenty of times and got on well. So it was a really good team. We've done some fast times in Derby. We've gone 350.1, I think it was. And it was like, shit, we could have gone some 350 in Derby, which is mental, because back when we were there as who what bike, it was like, if you went sub four there, like your mind exploded. It's like so fast, because Derby is a terribly slow track. So I kind of knew we were on in a really, really good place, probably more so than the other guys did, because I really appreciated how terribly slow Darvados can be. So when we got there and qualified fastest, so that though was like, yeah, something otherworldly. And suddenly it was like, damn, we can actually compete for the jersey here. I kind of thought, oh, maybe we'll be in a fight for a medal. If we go well, maybe we're in a bronze medal fight or something like that. And, suddenly you're in the... Well, in the first round against the Kiwis, who they absolutely killed us in the Kwame Games. They put 2.5 seconds into us. So yeah, to have the shoe on the other foot, as it were, and to really put them to the sword was quite nice, because I mean, they've got some amazingly strong guys, people like Aaron Gate, who are pulling absolutely silly turns. And yeah, we had a relatively comfortable ride against them. And in the final, kind of juggled our strategy around a little bit. And then Ethan Hayter could be let off the leash, as it were, in the final kilo, because you kind of held him close. Ethan Vernon wasn't in a great place at that time, so we were making sure that he wasn't getting absolutely murdered. So then he was still recovering and still performing well each pursuit. And then, yeah, we cut his turn down, and Hayter got another half lap or so and basically got told, yeah, do what you need to do. And Ethan just kind of told on. And Hayter did an absolute hero turn and just held off Filippo, matched Filippo for the final kilo, which was pretty epic. And we nipped it by 2 tenths, I think it was.
So what's the goal?
What's the goal? I guess the goal is to win the Olympics, isn't it? Some finished business.
I mean, you were in the other seat in a way. You were helping Denmark trying to win the gold, and then Ghana robbed us of that medal. So it's a pretty unique way to get into a team pursuit team that you've kind of carved out for yourself here.
Yeah, I think we've had obviously a lot of discussions throughout that entire, like, me working for the Danish period and into the Olympics and the other side. So it's been an odd journey. I don't think any other athlete has worked for another nation to then come back and race against that nation and worked and also for
one of
the
them
third
to do an
nation.
Hour record. Yeah.
It's a weird old dynamic. I totally appreciate that. But still, it's been, I wouldn't change it. I think it's made me who I am, and I've thoroughly enjoyed every step of the process. Being with the Danes, like, that was awesome. They helped me a lot as well. Not just, obviously, I was there as an employee, but they gave me a lot of opportunities that I wouldn't get elsewhere. And as an athlete as well, they enabled me to train with the world champions. Like, how cool is that? They literally let me just drop in and do team pursuiting with the world champs. It's absolutely nuts. Really, really thankful to them for what they gave me. And it's good to, I'm racing against them and like at Worlds to shake hands with them afterwards. And I got on really well, really, some really good friendships made there. So yeah, with the potential of racing Paris Olympics against the Danes and against the Italians, who, yeah, obviously through Filippo I work with as well. It's not dynamic, but I'm looking forward to it. Very excited. I'm all in for it. That is the goal. There's no hour records in the middle ground. It's all in for that.
Well, thanks very much, Dan, for this. We could be here all evening, which I always appreciate. But it's going to be a very exciting year, and to follow you with INEOS, obviously, but also with the track team. So thanks for that. And of course, check out Dan on his Instagram as well and Twitter. And his book as well, which is very good.
Yeah, check out Start at the End. Maybe get a second one going after the Olympics. We'll see how it goes. Thank you again, dude.